Our first matter this morning, 2023-0637, Erica Bargy versus the Village Council of the Village of St. Paris. On behalf of Appellant and Cross Appellee, Mr. Bowman. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
At this time, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court, Kevin Bowman, law firm of Brannan and Associates, on behalf of the appellant and cross-appellee, Erica Bargy. This is a case involving an appeal from an administrative appeal to the Common Pleas Court of the termination of a village police chief, former police chief Erica Bargy. There was a dispute in the town of St. Paris, Ohio, which is a statutory village and not a charter village, and so it follows the statutory procedures relating to the discipline of police officers and police chiefs, particular 737.171. And this case is a case largely involving statutory interpretation. We're talking about the interplay of two statutes, in particular the Open Meetings Act, RC 121.22, particularly Section G, subsection G of that statute, and 737.121, which involves the appellate rights and the processes by which a police chief in a statutory village undergoes discipline. There was a three-day hearing before the town council of St. Paris. Ultimately, the town council decided to discipline Chief Bargy and terminated her employment because of the accusation was that she had been insubordinate with respect to the mayor. We hope that we can get a new hearing in front of the new council and that determination will be overturned. In fact, in her unemployment hearing, the Employment Commission did find that Chief Bargy had not been insubordinate. So we believe that there's a possibility that had given a different fact finder that we could have that overturned. In any event, we appealed that decision under 737.171 to the Common Pleas Court. The Common Pleas Court ultimately affirmed the decision of the St. Paris Council applying a deferential standard instead of a de novo standard, which is the standard that we believe to be applicable. The other thing that happened that's important procedurally is that the Village Council voted to go into executive session over the objection of Ms. Bargy's counsel. Despite the objection, they did retire to executive session in order to consider her termination. And we
was there an actual written demand for a public hearing?
There was.
Okay.
Yes, there was a memorandum filed specifically demanding a public hearing, and then there was a specific objection made when the Village Council voted to retire to executive session.
Before the trial court, did you try to offer new evidence in light of it being de novo and
we did.
Appeal on
yeah, it was
fact
all,
and law?
Almost the first thing that we filed in the Common Pleas Court was a motion to supplement the record to add new evidence. So yes.
And the trial court denied it or granted it?
Trial court denied it. Trial court.
So you haven't actually, the second district remanded to the trial court, so that remand has not occurred yet. I mean, the actual second appearance before the trial court has not occurred yet, has it?
It has not. I think procedurally, Your Honor, if we win our appeal in this case, the case would ultimately be remanded to the Village of St. Paris Council for a new hearing. If we win the cross appeal, but not the appeal, then the matter would be remanded to the Common Pleas Court.
So, you believe the intent of the statute or the interplay, if someone demands a public hearing and gets a public hearing, as your client did, that it would require after the hearing takes place and the evidence is presented, that the council would have to deliberate in public out in front of everybody about what they think about what was presented?
Yes, in specific cases where the statute demands it,
as
in this
case. Does that make sense from a policy point of view? I mean, what if someone is questioning whether they're leaning one way or the other and the body goes back into deliberation and while they're in private, they can air their concerns, just like we do when we hear cases here in court. We go up into a conference room and deliberate in private.
Sure. And we, I think, Your Honor, that there are advantages to deliberations in public for a public body, and there are disadvantages, but this is one where the legislature has spoken, specifically with respect to Section 121.22G. They say, yes, all meetings are supposed to be open, but with respect to certain matters, councils can have executive session, including employment matters. However, when an employee specifically requests a public hearing, then those hearings have to be in public.
And I the hearing did take place in public. The only part that didn't was deliberations.
Well, I mean, the statutory section is specifically referring to executive session, right? I mean, it is saying you can go back to executive session, but you cannot go back to executive session when the employee requests a public hearing, which is what happened in this case. I think the legislature has weighed the pros and cons and has spoken in favor of having these sessions in public, and who am I to question them on policy grounds? If they want to rewrite the statute, they can rewrite the statute by a simple majority and get the governor to sign it. But what is at issue here is statutory interpretation. And here, I think the Polaris for this court, in my view, has always been that this court applies the plain meaning to statutes, that statutory interpretation to this court, at least for the last 15 years, as long as I've been practicing, this court has said over and over and over again, we're going to apply the plain language of statutes. This statute plainly requires that you can't go back to executive session when the employee requests a public hearing. That has to have some meaning.
How does this statute create a right for your client?
So this court has, of course, held that 122.21G does not create any right to a public hearing. You have to have a special statutory right to a public hearing, right? So for most public employees, there is no statutory right to a public hearing. But for police chiefs, 737.171 does create a right to a public hearing. It says that the specifically when a police chief has been charged with the various things that that allow the police chief to be terminated, that process of the discipline is to take place at the next public meeting of the legislative body, the village council. And so it is beyond demur that village council meetings are meetings under the Sunshine Act, under the Open Meetings Act, and the statute plainly requires, in my view, that the hearing that takes place regarding the termination of a police chief has to take place at the public hearing. When you combine that with 122,
what do you think the policy behind requiring a public hearing? What is that policy that supports that?
Well, I think the very same policy that generally supports the Sunshine Act.
So that the
Act.
Merits can be weighed of what they're deciding to do and questioned and probed, and so that the body can make a decision and the merits of what's being contemplated can be considered and either accepted or rejected, right?
So yeah, in public. And for, right. I mean, the entire, these are matters of public concern. This is a police yeah. chief in a village. The entire village is invited to the open public meeting.
But they think about the chilling effect of the decision that would take place if they had to deliberate in public. So that they hear the evidence. Let's say one of the council members is weighing in your client's favor. But all of a sudden the roll call takes place and it's going the other way and they're inhibited from expressing their views and maybe convincing some of the other members that maybe their position is incorrect.
I understand that would be a drawback. The other drawback would be that if there are secret dealings going on amongst council members, that those would be open to the public, that the entire village gets to see, how the sausage is being made. I think those are advantages that offset perhaps the policy disadvantages of deliberating in public, but it is one that the legislature has already spoken out on. The main issue here is that there are a number of
points. To your point, and I understand your argument about 731 and that there's a right to a public hearing, all that makes sense, but it wouldn't a much cleaner and more faithful way to the statute to resolve this case would be simply to overrule our decision in Matheny and Westlake? I mean, the statute seems pretty clear. It says official act, the section shall be liberally construed to require public officials to take official action and to conduct all deliberations upon official business only in open meetings. There's no quasi-judicial exception in the statute. That's something that judges just made up
judges
at one point.
Up.
So why shouldn't we just follow what the statute says?
I have not asked for Matheny to be overturned. I think Matheny is an opinion of longstanding and has been reaffirmed any number of times since then, including the Ross case and other cases.
But you'd agree it's inconsistent with the statutory language, right?
I think this, I read the Matheny case, and I think it was well considered. The court said that hearings aren't public meetings, and I'm willing to accept that. I would understand
but
if,
the, what the statute says is all deliberations. It doesn't all, say,
it does,
doesn't
it does
distinguish
not.
Between hearings and meetings, right?
I find your...
Really what happened here was a deliberation, right?
Yes.
And it didn't happen in an open meeting, correct?
It did not. You make a very convincing case, Your Honor. I was not expecting to argue Matheny because I don't need it to be overturned in order to win this case. I think we should win the case. The quasi-judicial exception that says that all hearings, that the statute doesn't apply to any hearings, I think is a terrible mistake on the part of the federal court that invented it and the courts that have followed it. And we would win if we simply eliminate that over-interpretation of Matheny, but if you chose to overturn Matheny, then we would also win. Have I only 3 minutes left of my time? I will have to retire in order to address the cross-appeal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Knight, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Taylor Knight. I am here on behalf of the appellant cross-appellee, Village of St. Paris. I am going to reserve, I think, 3 minutes of my time, hopefully I keep track of it, for rebuttal. With respect to the deliberations issue, appellant is asking this court to abolish the quasi-judicial exception to the Open Meetings Act, which we see throughout this court's case law. It's been held throughout history as something that's very...
And where is that based in the statute?
It's not in the statute, as the court's identified.
It's just something that judges made up.
It is, and I wouldn't go as far to say they made it up. I think that it's something that is a significant tenet of our judicial system, which you had identified, in that these type of deliberations, not only in a council meeting, but in this court as well, in a jury trial, courts have recognized, since courts have existed, I think, that it is important to have open, honest discussion. And I think when you are...
But, of course, but that's not what the legislature said, though. The legislature said all deliberations.
They did, and
this was clearly a deliberation. It was on official business.
It was a deliberation. It is on official business. But I think where we get away from the Open Meetings Act is, given that this is a quasi-judicial proceeding, and it is not in the statute, I recognize that there is no exception in the statute for this, but the deliberations in order to have an open and honest discussion and have people be able to voice their opinions, quite frankly, without fear of retribution or being seen in a different way, or to have the chilling effect that's been identified when you hold these deliberations, I think, quite frankly, for a jury trial or for this court in public, having people or the litigants that have a vested interest in the outcome sit there and watch, particularly in a small community like this where these are elected officials on the village council. Quite frankly, they probably don't get paid or paid enough, and they're really just doing it for the betterment of their community.
Do we have an obligation to follow the wording of the statute?
Which one, the Open Meetings Act?
Yeah, whatever.
All of them?
Any of them.
All of them.
I'm talking about a separation of powers issue here.
Sure.
Assuming the statute's not being questioned constitutionally, don't we have an obligation to enforce it as written?
You do have an obligation to enforce it as written. I believe that is correct, except that I do think this falls separately outside of the statute in that the deliberations are not part of a meeting. They are separate and distinct from the meeting, even which is what we see through the case law that's identified is, yes, this is a public hearing that's requested, and it is required to be in a, quote, open meeting of the village council. But the open meeting requirement doesn't make this proceeding part of the meeting. Instead, it designates the time and place when this is occur, when this quasi-judicial proceeding is to occur, which makes sense because the community has a vested interest.
But it's a deliberation, right? I mean, those are the words the statute uses, all deliberations.
It is a deliberation, but I would argue that since it's not a meeting, it is a quasi-judicial proceeding that's held at this meeting, it's not required to be in public. And I think if we look at the Open Meetings Act and the statute where it says an individual is entitled to request a public hearing, so in this case, Ms. Bargee wasn't required to request a public hearing. And so if you sort of take a step back and look at how this would have played out if she hadn't requested a public hearing, is a hearing still would have been held. She would have been invited into executive session of the council. She would be able to provide whatever evidence she wants to provide on her own behalf. And really, she's the one who gets to make the decision whether it is in executive session and the members of the community don't get to see her evidence versus in a public hearing and everyone gets to see the evidence against her.
Why don't they get to see the deliberations?
The deliberations then, so let me take a step back here.
Okay.
So if she requests the hearing to be an executive session.
No, the other way. She requests the hearing.
Well, right, I'm going to get there. Hold on.
Okay.
I promise. Gotcha. So if she requests it to be an executive session and she leaves and the deliberations are an executive session, we end up with the same result, right? And so...
Maybe. We don't know.
Well, arguably, I think you do because then you're still in private deliberations, whether it's an executive session or... in public, but she gets to control whether or not the members of her community, which she's a part of, and she has a vested interest in her reputation in the community, depending on what the charges are, get to actually watch and hear the evidence against her.
A city council member doesn't maybe change their view depending on what information is public? Is that what you're saying? They take the same viewpoint? That's what you're saying.
Yes. I'm going to say yes.
I guess I don't agree with that.
Well, I think, though,
They
can, but I think it's much tougher for an individual. I appreciate these are public officials. I appreciate that they put themselves in this position, but I think that it's much tougher for most individuals to sit and openly say in front of someone, I think you're a bad person.
The vote took place in public, right? They came back out and voted.
They did.
They did, okay.
They did.
So... How do we say the deliberations did not take place? Right now, I'm deliberating on this case. You don't know which way I'm thinking, sure. Right? So the deliberations, he says he does.
I wish I did. I'm going to be honest.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So... I'm sorry, I think I answered probably all of this and got through all of it. I'm not sure. But with respect to this, you know, it is the village's position that even Ms. Bargee was provided adequate due process. She requested a public hearing. That's what's permitted under the Open Meetings Act. There is a variety of case law related to other statutes, not this one, admittedly, this is the first time that addresses that this type of proceeding, regardless of the statutory language, is a quasi-judicial proceeding and that the deliberations are not part of the meeting and that it is, in fact, allowed to be in private, behind closed doors, if you will, if that's what council chooses, which is what they did in this case. And we would ask that this court follows the precedent relative to other boards, such as the Board of Elections, the Medical Board, holding that this is a quasi-judicial proceeding and that they were, in fact, permitted to have these deliberations behind closed doors. If you look at the whole of what was provided to Ms. Bargee, she was represented by counsel during a multi-day hearing, and we're not talking about a one-hour hearing where they then deliberate for hours behind closed doors. Instead, she was provided with 16 hours over the course of 3 days to present evidence. She was represented by counsels. She admitted exhibits. She proffered exhibits that weren't admitted by the council, and their deliberations, I think, were were totaled less than an hour with a little bit of time with advice from council for the village council. It's our position that that's what was required under the statute, that it wasn't in fact in quote open meeting, that it falls within the Open Meetings Act, and that they were entitled to deliberate behind closed doors. With respect to the cross appeal, the trial court, it's our position that the trial court got this right and applied a hybrid standard of review where its decision, the trial court decides if a preponderance of reliable, probative, and substantial evidence exists in the record to support the village council's decision to terminate the chief of police, giving deference to the village council's resolution of evidentiary conflicts and not substituting its judgment for that of the village council. This is the standard outlined in 250604 relative to appeals from an administrative agency.
Yeah, but in this case, it says questions of law and fact.
It does say questions.
And haven't we always interpreted that to mean de novo?
There are circumstances, I think, that you folks haven't, but I'll get there. Hold on. So it does say questions of law and fact. And I think the second district latching on to that information then turns to 2505.01 and uses the definition of law and fact and says this is a de novo review. I am not going to stand here and tell you guys that it is settled, it is very unclear, and it is very unsettled. And I think you see that in the briefing, is that different districts are doing different things. No court has specifically addressed the standard of review that's applicable to the termination of a police chief, which is 737.171. There's a little bit of confusion amongst the courts, I think, because there is a separate section, 737.19, which addresses termination of a police officer. Which is different than a police chief. And so we see the courts going back and forth, but our position is that 2501 doesn't apply, or 2505.01, excuse me, doesn't apply, because that only applies to an administrative officer, agency, board, department, tribunal, commission, or other instrumentality. St. Paris is a statutory village, which is a political subdivision under RC 2744.01F. And council is a legislative authority under 705.15. The section that Ms. Bargee submitted her appeal under, 2506.01, applies to, quote, a final order, adjudication, or decision of any officer, tribunal, authority, board, commission, department, or other division of a political subdivision. So that piece where it says it applies to an authority of a political subdivision is what connects us to this decision from the Village of St. Paris Council, the Village Council of St. Paris, to the section 2506.01. We also believe that the language in 2506.01 clearly asserts that the standard of review that is applicable to this type of appeal, or Ms. Bargee's appeal in this case, is contained in 250604, which is that hybrid standard of review that I've already identified, because 2506.04 actually modifies the standard of review applicable to administrative appeals, administrative officers and agencies. Specifically, if you take a look at the language of the statute, 2506.01A says, except as otherwise provided in section 2506.05 to 2506.08 of the revised code, and this is the important piece, except as modified by this section in the sections 2506.02 to 2506.04. So the remainder of this language is modified by 2506.04. Of the revised code, every final order, adjudication, or decision of any officer, tribunal, authority, that's what connects us to the Village of St. Paris, board, bureau, commission, department, or other division of any political subdivision of the state may be reviewed by the Court of Common Pleas of the county in which the principal office of the political subdivision is located, as provided in Chapter 2505. So we have, it's telling us we're pursuant to Chapter 2505, except as modified by Section 2506.04. And that language right there is what is connecting it to the standard of review that we've identified as the hybrid standard of review of 2504, and pulls it away from the law and fact analysis that we have identified in the definitions of 2505.01. And with respect to the law, questions of law and fact, this court has previously identified in, I'm gonna butcher this name, I apologize, but Dudovic v. Lorain Metro Housing Authority, 58 Ohio State 2D202, that the scope of the review under Section 2506 is not a de novo review, but resembles a de novo review. Specifically, 2506.04, which is the section we're advocating for a hybrid review in this case, requires the Common Pleas Court to examine the substantial, reliable, and probative evidence on the whole record, which in turn necessitates both factual and legal determinations. Under this standard, the Common Pleas Court must weigh the evidence in the record and whatever evidence is admitted pursuant to 2506.03, because that section does allow the appellant to apply for additional evidence, which she did in this case multiple times, to determine whether there exists a preponderance of reliable, probative, and substantial evidence to support the agency decision. So basically, even though it doesn't specifically identify a law in fact review, the trial court is in fact addressing both questions of law and fact under 2506.04, because it is permitted to accept additional evidence if it believes that the record is necessary to be supplemented. And in addition, it is actually engaging in this sort of legal factual review because it is in fact weighing the evidence that was submitted. I'm getting close to the end of my time, so I'm gonna save what I have left. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Bowman, you still have 3 minutes and 18 seconds.
Very good. Thank you, Chief Justice. With respect to the quasi-judicial exception that courts have created and that the Second District followed in the decision below, it is clear that this is a judge-made rule, and it conflicts with the express language of the statute, and that's the real problem that I have. The section of the Open Meetings Act specifically refers to an employee requesting a hearing. A hearing is by definition a quasi-judicial proceeding. If the legislature had genuinely contemplated that the Open Meetings Act does not apply to any quasi-judicial proceeding, it would not have used the word hearing in a subsection that gives an employee a specific right to request that public hearing, and that request then controls whether the legislative body is permitted to go back to executive session.
Does it create any problems for you when 737.71 simply refers to holding the hearing at the next regular meeting of the village council? I'm asking, does the language in 121 actually confer any kind of right in the context of 737?
Yeah, I think one has to infer that when the statute says that this event is supposed to happen at the next public meeting, that the legislature is contemplating that it will occur at a meeting of a village council.
Sure, that's when the hearing occurs.
Yeah.
But you just said we have to infer that, but on the other hand, you want us to not infer anything and just apply 121.
When I say, I don't think it's a great inference. I think it's in the language there. When I say, let's discuss this at the next public meeting,
next regular meeting.
Yeah.
Occurring not less than 5 days after the charges are filed.
Yeah. Let's discuss this at the next regular meeting, and this regular meeting is required by law to be public. I think the statute plainly contemplates that the events that are supposed to happen at the next regular meeting are going to happen at a public meeting. It's not a great logical leap there.
But then the context, though, at the next regular meeting, if it wasn't, the village council could, at a regular meeting, go into executive session for a variety of things, including employment matters, correct?
Unless the employee specifically requests that the public hearing under Section 122.21G not be public hearing.
Sure, but the hearing does occur. She has the right to cross-examine witnesses, et cetera, all the procedural due process rights, but does the statute need to be specific enough to say deliberation?
I think the statute does say deliberation in the Public Meetings Act. And what the 737.171 says that the whole thing is supposed to take place at the next regular meeting of the Legislative Council. Meetings of legislative councils are governed by the Open Meetings Act. I think it would be a judicially created exception to say that that requirement that it takes place at a public, at a regular meeting doesn't apply to either the executive session part or doesn't apply to the hearing part or doesn't apply to something. It is fairly plain language saying that we want this to occur at a legislative meeting, and legislative meetings are governed by the Sunshine Act. So they're supposed to occur in the sunshine. So that would be our position. I have very little time left. I do want to skip, to the cross appeal. So our appeal was specifically in writing filed under 737.171 throughout the entire process in the Common Pleas Court. We asked the court to apply a de novo standard. The court did not do so. And the plain language of the statute says that under 737.171, the appeal to the Common Pleas Court is an appeal of questions of law and fact. This court in 2015 in the Westlake decision said questions of law and fact are reviews de novo. And that has been true in Ohio case law. This court has said that time and time again for like 150 years. Cupp versus Toledo back in the 60s cited cases going back to before the Civil War. Questions of law and fact are reviews de novo.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Knight, you have a minute and 32 seconds left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just briefly want to address the comments of counsel relative to Ms. Bargee proceeding under 737.171 versus, I don't think he finished his sentence, but 2506. You will see if you look at the trial court briefing, I apologize, the clock didn't start, so if I run over, just let me know.
I'm watching.
Stop me. You will see if you look at the trial court briefing that she identified the statutory section of 2506 is how she was proceeding with her appeal in addition to 737.171. And it is our position, which is more fully explained in our briefing here on this issue, is that there is one standard of review. It doesn't matter if the appeal of this decision is under, quotes, under 737.171 or 2506, because the standard of review is the same for this decision. It doesn't make sense that there would be a different standard of review, so de novo standard of review for an appeal under 737.171 versus a review, a hybrid standard of review that we're advocating for under 2506. And the reason I say it doesn't make sense is because then the litigant could decide, well, do I want a new trial? Do I want a hybrid standard of review? And it just doesn't make sense that they're able to choose which standard of review that is applied to the decision of the administrative agency based on what statute they identify.
Doesn't in 2505.06, as opposed to 119, which are state agencies, sometimes these local board or commission hearings are very rudimentary. So when 731 says law and fact, why wouldn't we, even in conjunction with 2505.06, look at it that the trial court is able to take new and additional evidence? And I think we've even said that in some of our recent decisions.
They are, and I think that still the trial court is able to take new evidence under the hybrid standard of review that we're advocating under 2506.04. And they're able to do that when under 2506.03 is the trial court looks at the evidence in the record, because I am sure that there are statutory villages out there that aren't necessarily engaging in the due process that St. Paris did in this case. We have an extensive record that was before the trial court, and I think that's the reason that the trial court said we don't need any additional evidence. We've got 3 days of hearing transcript, we've got exhibits, we've got a finding of fact and law that was written out by the villages as required as well, and so they didn't need additional evidence. And I think that's where we get into they really are doing a hybrid review of law and fact, because the trial court under 2506.04 gets the opportunity to look at the record that was created administratively and decide if this is enough evidence for it to make a decision on the law versus if it needs additional evidence. And they're able to do that under 2506.03 and supplement the record if they think it's necessary.
But I think the trial judge, when he thought that the evidence, the judgment of the evidence was basically in equipoise, then just deferred to the hearing process. I mean, I think there's actually two things going on here. I think the trial judge did show deference when needed, but then did make its own judgments. But the fact that it didn't allow for, I don't think it gave as a reason that it wasn't allowing additional evidence because there was enough in the record. Am I mistaken?
No, I think that's correct, but I want to say it goes without saying in this case that we have enough in the record because it wasn't a rudimentary hearing. You know, we do have this entire transcript, and the entire proceeding was transcribed by the village. And so we've got, I think, 16 hours total of transcripts, which really is akin to what you would get in a jury trial. Some jury trials are even shorter than that. And so the trial court, looking at that record, says, we think this is sufficient to make our decision. And, you know, remember, under 2506.04, it's a preponderance of the evidence standard. And so it's not this extensive review. It's not a high bar for the evidence that the trial court really is making the determination. Are these facts reliable? Is this information reliable such that we have met the standard and I am not going to impose my decision on the village of St. Paris? My time is up. Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to argue before you today.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision from the court.